dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
as we you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we'll continue on the topic of understanding corporate rule for the purpose of discovering the foundation of its power and undermining it. Using the book, Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, a book of history and strategy, published in 2001 as our reference point. In addition to another reading from the book, I'm going to play you some material that illuminates the issue in various ways. We'll begin with a panel discussion on state surveillance that was held at the October 2009 convention of the National Lawyers Guild in Seattle. The discussion did not mention corporations as such, yet the framework of corporate rule underlies the surveillance of citizens by the state. In advance of every significant official gathering of the powerful, whether political conventions, economic summits, or trade negotiations, an increasing amount of law enforcement personnel and materiel are directed toward thwarting protest and other oppositional activity. This is justified under the rubric of public safety. When did you ever see such law enforcement power brought to bear against the violence and harm perpetrated by the corporate class against the citizenry every single day?
Our next speaker is Imam Mahdi Bray. He is the executive director of Mass Freedom, which is the civic and human rights advocacy arm of the Muslim American Society. And Mahdi is an incredible and powerful civil rights leader on broad issues of civil rights. He has been a leader in the anti-war movement. He has been an extraordinarily principled voice speaking out on behalf of people in the United States who have been targeted, who have been attacked, and also bringing together different communities to bring people together in order to have a united front approach to challenging the Bush administration and now the same programs into the Obama administration. I've had the great pleasure of working with him frequently on issues and civil rights issues and anti-war issues throughout the Bush years and now into the Obama years. And I especially want to thank him for coming here today from Washington, D.C. for this panel, because he is a voice that is unmatched on these issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Myra. I think you could have done just as well, but just say that Mahdi Bray is a professional agitator. But let me just say, in the name of God, most gracious, most merciful, I'm truly honored to be here. I'll greet you in the standard Muslim greetings of salutation. Assalamu alaikum. Shalom. Buenas noches. Como se va? Konnichiwa, namaste, izyabia yestalin, squadron, jumbo, and if I missed anybody, what's up? Obama, surveillance state, and the Bush legacy. Obama, the surveillance state, and the Bush legacy. Let me just state very emphatically, after countless appeals in the Muslim community to the Obama administration, its Justice Department, to roll back the horrific encroachments and attacks of civil rights and civil liberties that the Bush administration had previously conducted on not only the American Muslim community, but the American people at large, I have to say, there is no change. There is no change. Just as under Bush, now under President Barack Hussein Obama, I, as an African American, I, as a practicing Muslim, face the double whammy. I have to worry about driving while black and flying while Muslim. To many in the Muslim community, when it comes to civil rights and liberties, under Bush or Obama, it's like my grandmother would say, it's the same soup, just a different bowl. That soup contains spying and surveillance in our mosque. That soup contains agent provocateurs and often worshipers who are intimidated to spy upon their own fellow worshipers through threats of intimidation by the FBI and other forms of federal law enforcement. That soup contains profiling at airports with a watch list that contains Muslim activists. I'm on that list. Clergy and businessmen. That soup contains roving wiretaps, wantless wiretaps, national security letters, use of state secret privileges to hide the ball of justice that people seek in this nation. The soup also contains garbage in, garbage out data mining through places like the Homeland Security Fusion Centers dispersed all over this country. Just as Afghanistan is Obama's war now, the continual attack on civil rights and civil liberties through surveillance and other forms of violations of our civil rights and civil liberties does not belong to Bush. It belongs to President Barack Hussein Obama, Eric Holder, and Janice Neopolitano, and others of their ilk. Let me just say that no one has valued the significance of the historical election of Obama than I, as an African American. I grew up under apartheid in America, in the South. I witnessed our home being firebombed by the Klan in 1955. So it was a great moment. It was a great historical moment for this nation when an African American was elected to the highest office of the land. No one was more happier and no one took more jubilation than I. However, I must say that what we're facing and the challenge that we face as activists, as legal advocates, and as citizens is that there has been, if you will, a kumbaya moment within this administration that has created a sedative effect that is negating the most valuable tools that we have to keep our government in check. That's vigilance, and also that is scrutiny of what our government is doing. This is being outdated by what I call this touchy-feely kumbaya moments that we're having now, and our not willing, especially many of us in the progressive movement, to step up to the plate and criticize the Obama administration for its travesties against civil rights and civil liberties. The Obama, what I call love fest, It's like going to my Aunt Minnie back when I was a kid to get castor oil. Now, some of you may not be old enough to know what castor oil is like, but it is the most repulsive, revolting thing that you could give a child. And it has an awful taste, and then it creates a explosive effect much later in your tummy. Now, I had a cousin actually who ran away from home to keep from taking castor oil. This is true. But everybody sent their children to Aunt Minnie in my neighborhood in Norfolk, Virginia, to take castor oil, because she would put sugar cubes in it, then she'd squeeze some lemon into your mouth, and then you would get ice cream sandwiches and Pepsis. And so that kind of took away the whole thing of the bitter taste of castor oil. But later that night, believe me, and to some effect, this is what's happening, I think, with the Obama administration. We still have a corrosive situation going on. It's still a bitter pill when it comes to civil liberties and civil rights. But we're sedated with the fact of the, you know, yes, we can, you know, and change is coming and things of that nature. So I just want to quickly, as I said, I promised that I would be in my speech like Elizabeth Taylor was with all of her marriages. This won't be long. So let me just lay out some action items, I think, you know, because it's better to light a candle than curse the darkness. So I want to lay out some action items in terms of some things that I think that we can do. And I think the first thing, again, that we can do is not to give this president and his officials a pass for failure to change the old policies, which are now his policies. I think also we must see, when we talk about surveillance, we must see it in a much broader context. Often we don't see airport profiling and watch lists as a form of surveillance, but it is. As I travel to Egypt, I meet with political dissidents and other places throughout the Muslim world. You know, for these, you know, for many of these despot regimes in which our tax dollars, you know, uphold, Egypt being one of them. And I'm stopped. So consequently, I can't carry any documents given to me by dissidents, trade unionists, and other opposition in the area. My phone is requested to download whatever is in my phone, so I take a cheapie with me, you know. All of these type of things represent a form of surveillance. Data mining through the fusion centers is a serious form of surveillance, for it takes the information from Islamophobes and others, and they send it through a network of law enforcement from the federal, state, and local level, often prompting especially local sheriffs and local law enforcement who may have a decent relationship with the local Muslim community now to be suspicious. And the one that we were able to obtain for Virginia, it says that our organization, our mosque, our Boy Scouts and Girl Scout troops, our Muslim student associations are nothing but a conspiracy to overthrow the Constitution and establish Sharia. This is being promoted and propagated through Homeland Security's, our tax dollars, through the fusion centers. And this is what law enforcement sees. This kind of garbage in and garbage out. So that's another form. Also, collaboration, and this is something that's newly happened, and if I would, just allow me, because I want to give you the correct information here. But surveillance is also collaboration between private citizens and members of Congress to infiltrate Muslim organizations under false pretense, steal documents, and use them to promote hate, prejudice, and race in a racist book in the halls of Congress. Just off the press, my dear brothers and sisters. There is a book called The Muslim Mafia, written by an Islamophobe and an out-and-out racist. He had his son to go to the Council on American Islamic Relations, use a phony name, pretend that he was a Muslim, and work as an intern, whereupon he stole documents. There's nothing innocuous about the documents. They're documents. But he stole the documents, gave them to his father, who wrote this horrible book. And yesterday, oh, I'm sorry, day before yesterday, John Shadegg, congressman of Arizona, Paul Braun of Georgia, Trent Frank of Arizona, and Sue Maddock of North Carolina held a closed press conference on Capitol Hill, brought forth this book, and charged the Council on American Islamic Relations as planting spies in the Congress by encouraging young Muslims to become interns for members of Congress. Not only that, but they now have asked an investigation of the Council on American Islamic Relations through the Sergeant at Arms of the Congress. I'm so happy that Loretta Sanchez and Conyers have immediately denounced it and called it one of the worst things that they've ever seen, you know, done by members of Congress. This is tantamount to the same kind of stuff that took place with the NAACP and other groups that we know that went forth in the 60s. So, but this is happening, folks. Also, we must see surveillance also in the eye of having a foreign government through its embassy or its general consul office in Boston work. And I have the emails. We were able to get the emails through Discovery. Work with known Islamophobes and other, as the young people call, haters to attempt to do a hit piece to try to deny the Muslim citizens of Boston their First Amendment right to build a mosque. That's right. The council, I have the emails from the, it's called, the office was called, she's called the public, I mean, it's a political affairs director, was switching emails back and forth with the David Project, Truth for a Reconciliation, and Truth and Reconciliation and Tolerance Committee, which is a front organization for other Islamophobes. Steve Emerson, all of them exchanging emails. This is extremely dangerous. It is indeed a threat to U.S. security and even to our national sovereignty, that a foreign government can actually do that in this nation against American citizens. And also, in addition to that, I think another thing that we can do is there's a need for an ad hoc task force or coalition to take on issues such as agent provocateurs and infiltration, fusion centers, watch lists. We had some success under the Clinton administration and Janet Reno when we formed a coalition like that, the Coalition to Protect Political Freedom, on the issue of secret evidence. And Bush came along, he told us, I'm going to get rid of secret evidence. We're gonna stop secret evidence, and he was right. People went to jail not for secret evidence; they went to jail with no evidence. But in any event, these are some of the things that I think that we can do. And finally, I think that one of the things that can also take place is that within my own community, the American Muslim community, we must not be afraid. We must stand up. We must stand up to this administration. We must be willing to, you know, unfortunately the priorities, and I don't think they're bad priorities, but I think we can expand them. I do believe that Allah created us as Muslims to walk and chew bubblegum at the same time. But we give money to build mosques, good. We give money to build private schools, good. And we give money for relief organizations, mainly overseas. Good. But we have, as American Muslims in this country, we have enough resources to give money for these type of task force. We must reorganize and have a paradigm shift in the way that we handle our resources. And some of our wealth and money needs to go to many of you out here who are championing important causes as it relates to civil rights and civil liberties. That's something that our community needs to make a paradigm shift in. Also, we must give resources to, I think one of the things that we should do is we should FOIA them to death. I think that we should just continue to FOIA, court. I think that's one of a legalistic approach, I think, that will bear us fruit, you know. So I think that we should really do that. And I think the Muslim community must be part and parcel of that process and contribute to that process. Also, I think that the Muslim community, and I'm going to go ahead and say it because I don't mind, but we must call to task certain organizations, large national Muslim organizations, who will encourage the community to don't worry about the FBI spying in our mosque and putting in agent provocateurs. In fact, what you should do is put a big booth out and just, you know, everything is fine. If they come, tell them, talk with them. If you have nothing to hide, this kind of foolishness must be stopped. And I think we have to do it within our own house in the Muslim community. We must take on certain large organizations that have surgically attached their lips to the backside of the FBI. You can applaud for that. It's okay. We must build a strong united front with other groups, other faith groups, other secular and advocacy organizations. We must build a united front on these issues. And we also must take it to the streets. This April, we're planning a humongous march on Washington to say to the Obama administration that second-class citizenship is not an option. We must be willing to go out into the streets. And also, we must be willing to involve in other direct action campaigns. I think perhaps we need to get about 20 or 30 Muslims to go to Canada who will know that they're on the watch list, American citizens, of course, and then come back and be willing to go to jail before we tell them about what we read in the Quran, where we pray, how many times we pray, who's our sheikh, what madhhab or what form of religious jurisprudence we follow. We must be willing to do that. We must be willing to make those type of sacrifices, and God willing, we will. So let me conclude by just telling you a quick story. I can do it in 2 minutes. Can I get one more minute? Thank you. A quick story about the danger of ambiguity, because I do believe there's some ambiguity about this. We want to put everything on Bush and just give, you know, Obama a pass. We can't be ambiguous. It has a danger in ambiguity. We must be straightforward. As Malcolm X used to say, make it plain. And this goes back to the husband who had been married for 25 years. And he forgot his wife's 25th anniversary. Now, 25th anniversary is the silver anniversary. He forgot it completely. At midnight, she looked at the clock, and then she rolled over and looked at him and said, "How could you? How could you?" He said, "What, honey? How could you forget our 25th anniversary?" And he said, "Oh, my God. Honey, please forgive me." And he just went apologizing. And he was everything. And so finally he says, "What can I do? Is there any way I can make it up? And then finally she said, "I tell you what. It's our 25th anniversary, our silver anniversary. When I wake up tomorrow morning, out in front of that driveway, I want to see something shiny, silver, and then when I step on it, it can go from 0 to 200 in a matter of seconds." He said, "Honey, you got it." So he left early. The next morning, when she got up, she went through the kitchen, went into the garage, pushed the garage door, and there it was, in the driveway, glistening in the sun. Beautiful, shiny, a brand new shiny bathroom scales. I hope you get my point, that you have to be very precise about where you're going, what you're doing. So I just want to say, let's avoid the ambiguity. Let's call it what it is. This is not Bush issue now. This is an Obama issue when it relates to civil rights and civil liberties. And God willing, we must all press on to make this a better country and a better place to live.
Thank you, Imam Mahdi Bray. Our next speaker is Eileen Clancy. She's a researcher and media archivist who's worked principally in the U.S. and Northern Ireland. She directs the Eyewitness Video Project, which, as many people know, has been a key force in defending the civil rights of demonstrators during demonstrations, after demonstrations. The work of Eyewitness Video had a major impact at the RNC in 2004 when the work that they did showed over and over again that the police were lying when they were arresting and prosecuting people. And her work was so successful that it led to her and her group being raided repeatedly when it came time for the RNC in 2008 in Minneapolis. And she's here today to discuss these ongoing issues of surveillance, domestic spy, and infiltration within the political activists and how to address that in the U.S.
Thanks. Well, it's a pretty remarkable panel here. I was a little shocked when I found out who was on it, that I didn't really felt like I fit in. But I'll just do the best I can here as a non-lawyer and a media person. It's a funny thing. I was saying yesterday to Mara that, you know, what's happened since, say, 2000 in street protests, major street protests in the U.S., is that really almost nobody's coming anymore. There are very few protesters. Out in the streets, what you see are media, some legal observers, a lot of police, and some few passersby, and that's about it. So even though there's this major kind of gearing up, it's sort of the dirty little secret that I think that the demonization of the protesters, the takeover of downtowns by the police and the FBI at national special security events has been really successful. And there are very few people who are willing to go out in the street anymore. And those people who are frequently arrested en masse. So I'm just going to touch on a few things today, things that I collected over the last few years and that I've tried at times to get attorneys and organizations interested in following up, but really haven't had any success. for some reason, there just is not maybe the interest, maybe lawyers do litigation and they don't really do public education. But there just hasn't been a tremendous interest in this. And I think it's difficult work to follow up on, and I'm sure I don't know how to do it. But I'll also say, if the government is stuck with surveilling eyewitness video in the way they did last summer at the RNC, I mean, that's pretty sad. That's pretty sad. This is no replay of the 60s here. This is no replay of the 70s, even the beginning of the 80s. It's not like that. We just really run around with cameras. There's a tremendous amount of information that's available in, you know, the public record, in the news media, and I'm just going to read a few pieces. ABC News in 2007 got the hot tip that the FBI was proposing building a network of U.S. informants. The total cost of the effort topped $22 million, and the Bureau has arranged to use elements of CIA training to teach FBI agents about various things, comprehensive tradecraft. The Bureau apparently mulled whether to adopt the entire training course from the CIA or the Defense Intelligence Agency, which, like the CIA, recruits spies overseas, but they ultimately determined that it wouldn't meet their unique needs, noting that their domestic intelligence efforts are constitutionally sensitive. No doubt. And Stephen Aftergood of the Federation of American Scientists, who is an expert on U.S. intelligence programs and many things, said it's probably a good sign they're not adopting CIA recruitment techniques wholesale. And the article explains that U.S. intelligence officers abroad can use bribery, extortion, and other patently illegal acts to corral sources into working for them. And Aftergood said, you're not supposed to do that in the United States. In terms of constitutionally sensitive, and this was, our colleague stepped down for a moment, touched on this idea of going into Canada and what the FBI might say about you. Just so people might remember, 2007, two peace activists were denied entry into Canada after their names appeared in a database, an FBI database. And that's Anne Wright, retired Army colonel and former diplomat, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the women's peace group Code Pink. And they were told that they were in a NCIC database, and so they would not be allowed into Canada. But there is a mention in Anne Wright's statement to Democracy Now! That the database says that it's for people like foreign fugitives, 10 most wanted, people that are part of violent gangs and terrorist organizations. So that leads one to believe that they're talking about VGTOF, the Violent Gang and Terrorist Organization File, which is a database that's, I guess, mostly organized by the FBI, and is the seems to be at least one of the tracking databases that includes information about activists. It's very easy to get into that database. You can either be a self-admitted member in a group that, you know, was on the FBI list at the time of your arrest or incarceration, or any of the two following: identified as a group member by a reliable informant or individual, corroborated identification as a group member by an informant or individual of unknown reliability, frequenting a documented group's area, associating with known group members, this is all one category here, and or affects group dress, hand signals, tattoos, or symbols, and had been arrested with known group members and self-admitted group membership. So that's very easy to get into. If I can just get, let's see. I believe there was a Wall Street Journal article that said, I think in 2003 there were 7,000 names in that database. And it used to be, at least, that was treated as a sort of a database mostly foreign people that the FBI was tracking. And then by a couple of years ago, the database had over 100,000 members, and I think 300, some of them, were foreign, according to a GAO report, which leads one to believe that it was actually a domestic database. probably most of you know that events like the presidential conventions are designated national special security events, which means that the FBI is in charge of law enforcement and intelligence. And there is a fellow who ran the FBI Special Events Management Unit in Washington, G.B. Jones, who wrote a thesis that was published in 2005. It's approved for public release, distribution unlimited, so it's just a you can find it on the internet, Towards a Strategic Approach to Special Events Management in the Post-9/11 World. And it was for his MA at the Naval Postgraduate School. So the purpose of the thesis, he says, is to identify a way forward. Now, this, remember, this is September 2005, so that the FBI special event preparedness goals may be expressed in terms of an end state toward which the program should strive. So presumably, if he's still involved, you know, that's been part of, these are part of his goals. The author participated in numerous meetings and briefings related to major events and was actively involved in counterterrorism planning and implementation at events like the FTAA in Miami, Florida, Democratic Convention in Boston in 2004, and the RNC in New York. So this person knows presumably wherever he speaks. There is a discussion of the laws that the FBI should seek to enforce at these events. And there's a note that effectively policing special events requires strategies that are not limited to the use of terrorism statutes. In particular, statutes related to civil disorders and riots, interstate travel and aid of racketeering, and so forth. I'm just skipping about just to give you a little bit of a flavor. The he speaks about an evolution in planning of these events, noting that special event planning has traditionally been focused on crowd control and public safety. So, and that after September 11th, there was a movement from that to domestic incident management, which they call an all-hazards approach, right? So they're not just looking at terrorism, it's sort of everything. And there's a discussion of how to integrate local police forces and the FBI, including that in that area. There's a note. It says the FBI has a large amount of strategic intelligence concerning groups and individuals involved in illegal behavior, including those who engage in violent activity at protest events. They recommend coordination of intelligence collection and distribution. And there's an interesting phrase that comes up. A direct quote is, "This approach also fosters legacy intelligence that can be used for future events." The author comes up with a category that I don't think is a legal term. I think it's his own category, politically charged special events. So these are the not up to the level of national security special events designations. So one of the benefits of aggressively prosecuting crimes that occur at PCSEs is that certain crimes qualify as predicate offenses for more complex racketeering prosecutions. Appropriately documenting predicate offenses increases the options available for use against the violent criminal actors who travel between states to commit violent criminal activity at multiple PCSEs. Subsequent crimes can be investigated as part of a terrorism enterprise investigation, and they may be prosecuted under the anti-racketeering statutes. So the author, and I don't know if this is exactly what's occurred in the meanwhile since 2005, but the author is recommending RICO prosecutions and terrorism, opening terrorism enterprise investigations. I thought one of the most fascinating parts of this document was the section on information sharing. He notes, different law enforcement agencies, now this was, of course, at the time, it's different now, I think, working the same crisis events use different information technology for managing crisis information. The FBI and other law enforcement agencies routinely work around this limitation by exchanging liaison officers between different command posts and operations centers in an attempt to maintain situational awareness. So because information comes in, it's put in different computer systems, and it can't be really shared, but people can talk, live humans can talk to each other. So that's one of the ways they work around it. The FBI uses an incident management database called ICON to manage crisis information. And the author notes, much of the information collected during special events, particularly politically charged special events that involve protest activity, may not be collected or recorded in ICON or ACS because of federal privacy legislation. The FBI has an operational need to monitor it, so a system was developed to track, display, and disseminate incident-related information that does not meet the criteria for inclusion in an FBI database of record. That tool is the Virtual Command Center, VCC, on Law Enforcement Information Network. It's still considered a work in progress as of that point. In 2007, I printed something out about this. It's a law enforcement online service, which is one of the ways you get this VCC. And it's a little thing from the FBI press room, and it notes that the LEO is used in Iraq through our virtual command center by members of the coalition forces, United States, Denmark, UK, Canada, Australia, and Japan, and it's been very effective. And I'll close with an example about law enforcement online information sharing, again, from the FBI website, noting that the Virtual Command Center system launched in July 2004, which would be shortly before the Republican convention in New York. And here's one of the ways it worked at an event. For example, law enforcement personnel working a recent Academy Awards ceremony observed several unauthorized people in a restricted area carrying balloons. The incident was reported to the VCC and immediately posted. An officer working the event saw the notice. He knew from previous experience that the individuals were probably anarchists who intended to throw balloons filled with paint and other liquids and share that information through the VCC. The officer's action helped ensure that the group was detained without incident. So there's an example of how that can work. So just a few bits and pieces from a little survey of some of the tools that are available that you might or might not be familiar with. And thanks for your time and attention.
Thank you, Eileen Clancy. Finally, I'm going to speak briefly and share the time with my partner Carl Massinio from the Partnership for Civil Justice, and then hopefully we'll have a few minutes for discussion. I wanted to address, picking up on a number of different points that have been made here, and I really want to thank the panelists because everyone has been, I think, just really excellent. I think I disagree with Eileen on the issue of protesters in the streets, and I think we have a disagreement. I don't think that people are not in the streets because of the police repression. I believe the police repression has an impact, unquestionably. And I think in advance of demonstrations, the demonization has an impact on many people who would either come out into the streets, but then are sort of told this is criminalized activity and criminalized behavior, which is something that most of us who are litigating these issues or advocating these issues really fight against. Because the point is, these are cherished First Amendment activities. Everyone should be able to come out. Everyone should speak their mind. I think there's an ebb and a flow within the movement, as always. And at this time, and relating back to what Mahdi was talking about with the election of Obama, there is unquestionably a demonstrable ebb in terms of people coming out into the streets because there was this great hopefulness. And that was the thing about the election. There was a great hopefulness that people thought, so many people who may not have been that politically active before thought, well, maybe there is an opportunity to do something. Maybe there is a change. The issue becomes the next step. Is it at that moment that then you sit back and wait for the President of the United States and the Democratic Congress to do all the things that need to be done? You can see, everyone here knows, it's not happening. It will not happen. The only way that the changes will occur, that must occur, are going to be because of the movement in the United States, of education of people in the United States, of lawyers and legal advocates who are standing behind them and who are backing them, and the efforts that we make to unravel, in this particular context of this panel, the domestic spying and the mass surveillance. Millions of people in the United States are basically have been wiretapped, have been dumped in databases, not for any allegation of any criminal activity, but because they were engaged in religious activity, political activity, not criminal activity. Not criminal activity. And we have a right for two things, minimally. We have a right to have those databases exposed for people to be able to have that information identified and to have that information erased. At the Partnership for Civil Justice, we launched an expose and expunge campaign that we're hoping that people will join, and we'll be doing more in the coming months on this. And it has to be a two-pronged attack. It has to be FOIA demands. It has to be litigation. It has to be people pounding the pavements. It has to be people making a demand. This is a just demand. Most people in the United States who learn about this think it's intolerable. I mean, why the hell should anyone be stuck in a government law enforcement database because of your political thoughts, because of your religious activities, because of your associations, or because you stumbled into some peripheral category that then locked you in there? And as Madi was talking about the fusion centers, I mean, these are, you know, this is billions of dollars of operation coming from Homeland Security on multiple levels, the local level, the regional level, the state level. And it's a juggernaut. It's an entity that has so much funding, and it has to find an enemy. And when you have billions of dollars and 800,000 law enforcement officers in the United States being told, go find the enemy, odds are they're going to find the enemy. And the enemy they're finding are political activists and Muslims and other people who are engaged in lawful activity. And that information is being pushed through and advocated and dumped in, as well as Madi was talking about, by Islamophobes, by right-wing activists in the United States working hand-in-hand with law enforcement. And it's become a massive political tool and one that we have to dismantle. The fusion centers are not, obviously, the only element of what's going on. As Eileen talked about, you have the VGTOF. You have many different databases. There's the high-intensity drug trafficking area database, which high-intensity drug trafficking naturally, as we have found, contains anti-war protesters. And, you know, the investigative data warehouse, which is like such a big, secret, huge operation, they don't even want to tell anyone about it. And EFF has been doing really good FOIA litigation on that. One wrote in, which I think Carl will talk about, but what we've done in our litigation, and as Eileen was touching on, in these demonstrations, the FBI and law enforcement are using the demonstrations as mass intelligence gathering, using mass arrests, illegal false arrests. We represent two classes, more than 1,000 people, false arrested in Washington, D.C., in two different incidents alone, where we believe that the FBI used the mass false arrests for mass intelligence gathering. What we did in one of our cases, in just the last couple months, one, and it's the only ruling we know of in the U.S., and we put our materials on the disk so you have it, is we demanded, as part of our relief, is expungement. And so based on that issue, we demanded that the FBI has to search their super-secret databases, the ones that they won't tell anyone about. And we actually got an order from the court telling them they had to run our clients' names through, you know, the VGTOF, all of these different databases that they're always arguing. Their argument is, that great argument, we can't tell you if you're in the database, because then you're a terrorist and you know you're in the database, and we can tell you you're not in the database because then you're a terrorist and then you would know that you're not in the database and you'd have that advantage of knowing that you are a terrorist, not in the database. And therefore, we can tell no one ever in the United States whether or not you, as a person living in the United States, are in our massive law enforcement databases. This has to end. So we think that that's a really good ruling that we're hoping that people will be able to start to use, and it should be part and parcel of protest litigation, that you should be doing demands for expungement. They'll tell you, yeah, we'll expunge and look at the NCIC. Well, the NCIC is just not that big of a deal. It's the criminal list. It's, you know, are you arrested? And yes, you have to go after that. But you can't let them end there. And as I said, we've provided materials and are happy to provide more materials to people on what you're looking for and how to go find it. And finally, just as one point, you know, when Steve's talking about the state secrets issue. We've had them assert state secrets privilege in our litigation on discovery issues, not as a game ender, but as to documents that we're entitled to. In one case, we had the government asserted state secrets, I think, like 267 times. And we actually got our hands on one of those state secret documents. And we got it, obviously not through the federal government, but because the municipality was so stupid, they gave it to us. And this great state secret document was the terrorism threat assessment for January 2001, for the time of the first Bush-Cheney inauguration. January 2001, right, 8 months before September 11th. The document, I don't remember, it's about 15 pages long. The first page has this passing, scant reference to Osama bin Laden and the USS Cole. The entire rest of the document, the state secret terrorism threat assessment, multi-agency, January 2001, protesters, political protesters, what they were thinking, what their email said, where they're meeting, the Anarchist Bowling League meets at 7:30 on Thursday night. That's what they were doing. That tells you everything about the U.S. government's use of the word terrorism, everything about their surveillance and their intelligence gathering. It is a political tool. And it's a political tool that the National Lawyers Guild members and that the activists we work with have the ability to unravel, to expose, and to end. And I want to pass this on to Carl Messinia. Thank you.
I'm very much heartened to be standing at the front of a standing room only seminar at the National Lawyers Guild Convention on Challenging the Surveillance State. It's a room that is clearly filled beyond capacity with National Lawyers Guild attorneys, legal workers, law students. And when I look out at the crowd, I think of those HUAC documents and the other government documents identifying the National Lawyers Guild as a subversive organization. And I look out at so many familiar faces, so many subversive elements, all in this room. And I just want to say I'm honored to be here in such good company. Because we know it's the surveillance state that is really what is subversive. It's the surveillance state that's subversive of our constitutional rights, of our civil rights, of our rights to religious freedom, to freedom of association, to the basic freedom to be free of government misconduct. So, and I know that the Guild-associated attorneys, unlike perhaps others who may be interested in refining the surveillance state, the National Lawyers Guild-associated attorneys and legal workers and law students are interested in bringing it down. And if we can't bring it down today, we're going to bring it down incrementally by obstructing it case by case, client by client, opportunity by opportunity. And that's one of the things that we have here that is different than, say, any other just ordinary gathering of persons. The Guild recognizes and historically has exercised the power to impede unlawful government conduct. We have the use of litigation. We have the tools that come with that. So in all of our cases that we bring, it's essential that we focus not just on what we may have been focusing on, the immediate effects of a false arrest, but we recognize that because the surveillance state is omnipresent, surveillance is actually an issue that is omnipresent in our cases. Every arrest of a political activist or a religiously based arrest has got a component of surveillance. And the concrete manifestation of that, the end product of that, is the depositing of data into databases. And that's what they don't want us to know about. That's what they try and keep secret, is what are those data collections. But we have an avenue in. We have an avenue in through our litigation. We have an avenue in through our claims for equitable relief. Every arrest is going to lead to deposits of data in databases now. Not just the NCIC, but in the super secret ones that they don't want to talk about. And every arrest, every false arrest, has expungement as a proper remedy. So that means that for us as attorneys, every time we have a case, we have to think, let's follow the trail of the data. Demand and discovery. Where does the data go? Where is it deposited? What are the record-keeping systems? What are the fields of data? How is it disseminated? How is it distributed? Because we have a right to know, because we need to expunge the unlawful entry of data that comes from, for example, false arrests. When we're doing our claims, we know that, for example, the government always says you can't challenge surveillance, that layered is this huge obstruction under the law. But in fact, it's an extremely narrow case, and the cases subsequent to it characterize it as that. And it's very clear that surveillance, when accompanied by unlawful disruption or unlawful conduct, can be challenged by claims for injunctive relief to make it stop. So that, for example, in our case coming out of the January 2001 inauguration, where it was discovered that the undercover agents were shockingly engaging in acts of provocation, secreting themselves among protesters in organizing meetings and coming up with these ridiculous demands that others plant bombs or plant fake bombs and call in bomb threats, things that was extremely disruptive, in fact, to the organizing activities, because everyone that was engaged in political activism was not engaged in that, and that really brought things to a, you know, to a stop. We were able to demand and get a court order that the MPD in that case disclosed to us all of the identities of their undercover agents, so that we could then show them to key activists and they could associate who said what to whom on what days to build our case for unlawful disruption. And the government said, but if you do that, that's going to destroy the effectiveness of our undercover activities. Well, so this is what we need to be doing, and there's a lot of materials that have been distributed. We're happy, certainly, to share everything that we have done, and we certainly ourselves benefit from the free exchange with other attorneys working across the country, and I'm very happy to be here and appreciate everyone's time here.
So while we're technically at the end of our time, I'm sure we can steal a few minutes if the hands are going up. And Lynn Stewart is here, and actually, do you want to come up here?
Yeah.
That would be great. I know that everyone in the room knows Lynn Stewart, but Lynn, just give her the ovation.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring to everyone's attention an organization that was founded about a year ago in Albany, New York, of all the strange visitors. Oh, someone's giving a heads up back there. Yay. And it came out of a trial that was held there in which an imam and a pizza shop owner were accused of trying to purchase Stinger missiles to send to Osama. It seems so absurd, but a jury convicted, and they are each doing more than 20 years right now. So this is not just, you know, for us as lawyers, what a fact pattern this is, but it is real. And these folks, who are mainly peaceniks from Bethlehem, New York, who were asked to attend the trial as witnesses to what the government was doing, became so incensed at what they observed that they decided they had to found a group. And the group that they have found, and they were good enough to include me as their keynoter and as an active member, is Project Salaam, S-A-L-A-M, Stop All the Lies Against Muslims. And it is a mixed group. It is activists, it is Muslims, it is imams, and basically it's a data collecting thing, among other things. In other words, they are asking every lawyer, every activist who has participated in one of the criminal prosecutions, these absurd prosecutions brought on by agent provocateurs, such as the one in Florida where the five young men were taken to trial three times before they got a conviction on the most absurd pretexts, but that all this information should be in a database for lawyers to use. For example, the fact that they use anonymous juries exclusively in these Muslim cases, which of course communicate to the jury, you're in big trouble here, we can't even know your name, these people, they're dangerous, so side with us, your friendly government, and convict them. So it's a wonderful tool. It's online, Project Salaam. It's got a terrific listserv, which is tops in disseminating. And I'll just close with this. The agent that was used as an informant in the Albany case involving the imam and the pizza maker resurfaced about 3 months ago in a case in Newburgh, New York, where they accused a group of young men in the mosque of planning to bomb a synagogue in a fancy New York suburb, Riverdale. And it turned out it was the same agent as was used in the Albany case. So I'm proud to say that Project Salaam, without consulting lawyers or anything else, which might have given them not so good advice, went ahead and published this guy's picture to every mosque in the Northeast, or as many as they could contact, to say, look out for this guy. He's infiltrating. He's interfering with your right to worship, and you should be aware of it. This, I think, is a progressive step forward. I'm not sure if a lawyer was called, they wouldn't have said, you know, the FBI may come after you. But at any rate, they have championed many cases. They are a goldmine of information. They are also available to organize around cases of this sort. And as I say, S-A-L-A-M, easy, and I can only tell you that I've been so encouraged by them because, you know, so many of the cases, there's absolutely no public response. They're tried in empty courtrooms. Nobody gives a damn. So I think that should be an important part of, if the guild, we are involved with them through me, of course, but and other guild lawyers, but I think that's an important thing to get together with groups like this and support them. Thank you.
You were listening to a panel discussion, The Surveillance State and Domestic Spying in the Obama Era, held in October 2009 at the National Lawyers Guild Convention in Seattle. Thanks to Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio for that recording.